I am very, very grateful to be with you this evening. Columbia University is renowned throughout the entire world as one of the premier educational institutions that is producing the future leaders of the world. When we have something which gives us power, such as knowledge, influence, wealth, strength, with that comes a very, very great responsibility. And how the leaders of the world take responsibility for encouraging morality, virtue, character, and the pursuit of real happiness is one of the most important subjects of the world today. In the world we live in, integrity and character is in a very short supply. It is the philosophy of all ancient traditions that these are the most sacred and valuable aspects of human life. The great Greek philosopher Plato, he taught that virtue is the central theme of human life. But oftentimes, when things come out of balance in a very consumer-driven society, something like virtue has no utilitarian value. It does not help us to earn money, to gain power, or to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of the senses. And that is very much a situation that the world is in today. Just a few years ago, on September 11th, when the World Trade Center tumbled down in that great, horrible disaster, it was a turning point for many Americans in how they valued what was sacred in life. It was as if a facade representing what was sacred to them crumbled down into dust. And in the process, so many thousands of people killed within a moment. And soon after that, there was the scandal of Enron and WorldCom, big, powerful, wealthy people, corporations that were employing and influencing so many thousands and thousands, in fact, the world. To see such cruelty, selfishness, and corruption amongst big people, wealthy people, influential people who were leaders of so many, it caused so many Americans, and for that matter, people throughout the world, to question what is sacred in life? What is really success? Is it power and money? Money is good, but only a very foolish person will equate money to happiness. In fact, suicide, drug addiction, alcoholism, and so many other expressions of depression are amongst the very, very wealthy people in society. I was recently speaking to one of my friends. He was a counselor for a person who, years ago, in a poll, was voted the most popular man on earth. He was a very famous athlete. He came from a ghetto. He explained to my friend that my whole life, when I was a child, I was just thinking, if I could get out of this horrible neighborhood and have a nice house and have a nice car and have money and have beautiful women, and if I had fame, then I would be happy. He said, now look. Look at this mansion I'm living in. Every piece of furniture is imported from various parts of the world. And I could call any woman anytime and she's mine. And I drive Rolls Royce. And I'm known by everyone. But it only gives me anxiety. I don't even know who my friends are anymore. Who's trying to use me? Who's trying to exploit me? Who could I trust? He said, I was happier when I was living in the ghetto because it was a simple life. Now things are so complicated and so much anxiety. That is a reality. But we are being conditioned and taught to think that happiness comes through to what degree we can accumulate. But what is real? What is real success? People began to question when they saw here in New York City that at any moment everything could collapse. What is sacred in life? What is lasting in life? What brings about real happiness? These are the same questions that are asked and addressed in all the great cultures of wisdom and knowledge throughout the history of humanity. In the ancient Sanskrit literature, Vedanta Sutra, it begins with this question, Atato Brahma Jigyasya, that now that you have attained the valuable, precious form of a human being, understand who you are. What is your relationship with God? What is your relationship with other living beings? What is your relationship with nature? And to live according to our original natural instinct, our original nature. For the past 30 years, technology was seen as boosting society. But things are changing today. People are becoming more concerned, even governments and big businesses, in consciousness. Consciousness of how to value a human being, not just as a worker or as a consumer, but as a person who has their rights and who we must satisfy. I was just speaking to one very successful businessman, and he was telling me that one of the great companies, Xerox Company, said they were making all their machinery in such ways, and there was so much pollution they were creating But they had a realization. They actually went on a retreat and had to try to, because business was going down, how to actually live better in harmony with the real needs and wants of the people. So they made a Xerox machine that was recyclable. Every ingredient in it was recyclable. Is that recyclable? It's the biggest consumer product that they ever had. Selling like anything and making them millions. Because people in today's world are becoming more aware of the environment. People are becoming more aware of basic principles of virtue and morality. And one of the unfortunate reasons why is they're seeing the dissatisfaction and dissolution of so many of the false ideals that simply material acquisition and power will bring satisfaction, individually or collectively. What is consciousness? According to the ancient Sanskrit literature, Bhagavad Gita, consciousness is the living force within a living being's heart. And what is the nature of that living force? It is the life-giving substance to the mind and the body we live in. This living force is passing through the various stages of life, from childhood to youth to old age. Our mind is changing, our body is changing, but who are we? Is there any classes in our colleges today that sincerely address this issue? Who am I? We are the eternal spiritual spark, the life-giving force, which is part and parcel of the Supreme, and which shares an independent free will as a part of the Supreme. And how we utilize our free will at every moment is how we are going to either elevate or degrade ourselves, and how we're going to affect the society and the environment around us. This is the responsibility of human life. What choices we make at every moment. Temptations and fears within this world can bring down the morality, the ethics, and the nobility, even of a person who's striving to be good. So many temptations. And it's not that maybe they will come. They will come. Temptations and fear. There's so many easy ways to succeed if we just sell the values and ideals that we hold sacred for the purpose of some temporary benefits. Thus, it is very important that we have a strong foundation to build our integrity upon. And the strongest foundation is a foundation based on truth. And that truth is to understand, what is my original nature? Who am I? What is my relationship with God, with others, and with my environment? Therefore, knowledge, spiritual knowledge, is very, very essential to sustain real integrity, morality, and a genuine purpose and fulfillment in life. The active principle of this world is selfishness. That life is to fulfill our desires. The fundamental point of market economy is that as a human being is the sum total of his or her desires, and that happiness comes through the fulfillment of those desires. Now, this ideal is diametrically opposed to all the great cultures of wisdom throughout the history of humanity. It's not that life is to desire. It's that we should understand that desire is because of life. And what is life? Life is the presence of a part of God, the eternal soul within the heart. And what are the needs of the soul? Until we understand that, can we actually experience real happiness? Ananda Mayobhyashat. Every living being is seeking pleasure. The insects are seeking pleasure. The lizards are seeking pleasure. The squirrels in the forest here in Columbia University are seeking pleasure. And whether a person is male or female, Asian or European or African or American, everyone is seeking pleasure. Why? Why we all have that in common? Because the nature of consciousness is such an ananda. It is eternal, full of knowledge, and full of happiness. We're seeking that pleasure that is within through so many diversions outside of ourselves. But actually, where is happiness to be found? What is the basic essence of happiness? If you're the proprietor of a whole planet and you're the only person alive, will you be happy? Happiness is love. Happiness is reciprocation. You can't be happy with things. Real happiness of the heart comes through the expression and the exchange of love. Sex is very highly promoted in today's world. What is sex? It is a very external, superficial, physical search for that experience of love. But actual love is of the heart. It's not of the flesh. It's not of the mind. It's of the heart. And that is what every living being is looking for, groping for, longing for. We're trying to find it in our power, in our wealth, in our skills, in our education. Ultimately, we're all seeking love, because that's the only thing that can actually satisfy the needs of the heart. I remember some years ago, I was with Mother Teresa in Calcutta, and she told me something that I really appreciated. I went into her ashram, and she was scrubbing pots. She was all black with soot. She was scrubbing pots. And this is a couple years after she won the Nobel Prize. But it didn't change her. She was simple, just serving. Her happiness was serving others, with or without a Nobel Prize, with or without her world fame. She told me that the greatest problem in the world today is hunger. Not hunger of the belly. Hunger of the belly is very easy to satisfy. You just give some food. But that doesn't satisfy a person. The real hunger is the hunger of the heart. And she said, I travel around the world, and I see the people who have the hungriest hearts, the emptiest hearts, are the very powerful, wealthy leaders of society. They have everything around, but they're starving within. And the whole world is chasing to be like them. When you get to that place, you realize there's nothing there. She told me that the only thing that can feed nourishment to the heart is the love of God. That is the greatest challenge in today's world, to give that. She said, when the poverty-stricken beggars of Calcutta die in my arms, she said, I see light in their eyes. I do not see that light in the aristocratic people of the West. Who's actually in poverty? Recently, I was in Bombay with a very dear friend. His name is Alfred Brush Ford, the great-grandson of Henry Ford. And he was giving a lecture to about 5,000-6,000 people. And he was explaining his own realization. He said, you people of Bombay, you're all trying to find happiness, fulfillment in accumulating more and more wealth and power. I was born with it. He said, I had everything materially that a person could want. He said, let me tell you, I've been on that road, I've gone to the end of that road, and there is nothing there. Unless we have inner satisfaction, unless we have something very sacred that we hold as our ideal in life and pursue that without hypocrisy, there can be no real fulfillment. So what is real leadership? Leadership, according to the Bhagavad Gita, it is a service and it is a responsibility. Because what the leaders do, the common people will follow, be very much influenced. Who are the leaders of the world today? Recently, I was in India. This is a few years ago, actually. And I was on an airplane with one of the stars of the Indian cricket team. Do you know what is cricket? It's not just an insect. It's the most popular sport. If you take baseball, football, basketball, and put them all together, in India you get cricket. People are mad after cricket. I've been living in India since 1970, and I still haven't figured out how they're playing this game, what they're doing. It just doesn't make any sense to me. But that's my cultural conditioning. And the cricket stars, they're the ultimate heroes of this society. Yes? Would you agree? They're from it. See? Even they know that. So this cricket star was, everyone was chasing after him for his autographs and to talk to him, to get photos with him. And he was completely miserable. He would not look at anyone. He would not talk to anyone. On the plane, he was pretending to be sleeping the whole time so no one would bother him. And as he went off, he just looked forward and people were coming. He just ignored them and walked right by. And at the baggage claim area, I was standing next to him and he just wouldn't look at anyone, wouldn't talk to anyone. The pilot was coming out. Oh, please, you know, I'm so happy. He just, all the hostesses were coming out. The airline traffic control people were coming. He just, So I walked up to him. I said, can I help you? You really look sad. Can I help? Is there something I can do to help you? And he looked at me and he said, Swamiji, thank you very much. I need help. And then he opened up and just revealed his heart to me, how much difficult it was to be in that position. And I told him that you have a great responsibility, because whatever you do will be the standard you're setting for millions of young people. They're going to follow what you do. The quality of your life will be what they strive to be. And that is a fact. So we came out together, and a very amazing thing. The next day was Sunday, and I was giving a lecture at our temple. And there's usually over 1,000 people that come. And all the young boys, they never come to the lecture. They're always outside playing cricket. Yes, during the lecture, they're outside playing cricket. And I'm speaking, and the adults are there. On that next Sunday morning, all the young boys were in the front row. Because now they're taking me seriously, because I'm a friend of the cricket star. Now they thought that there's something valuable that Swamiji will speak. So when we have influence in people's lives, when we have leadership, we're setting the standards for the people who we are influencing. It's a very, very great responsibility. The greatest need in the world today is leaders that have character and integrity. One great definition of character is this: the character of a person is the substance of the ideals that that person holds sacred in their life. That constitutes our character. What is our ideals, and how we're harmonizing every aspect of our life to live by those ideals? What happened in Enron and WorldCom? These people had so much money and power and influence, but what was their ideal? Greed is like fire. Greed can never be satisfied by feeding it fuel. But if we have inner satisfaction, then we can actually function within society in an exemplary way. So yes, many of you are students, some are professors. What really is the ideal that you're going to hold sacred in your lives? Spiritual leadership is accessing the divine energy within us. Spiritual leadership is based on the principle of humility. Trinarapi sunichena taror ibasihishnu. That a real leader, in a spiritual sense, never thinks that I am the master, but always feels that I am the servant. I'm not the proprietor. I'm the caretaker. If we have humility, we will respect all living beings. If we have humility, we will not become proud. When we are proud by what we have, we try to impress people. But the result is usually always the opposite of what we want. People envy us. When we have a lot and we're proud of it and boastful of it, people will respect us. People will honor us. usually because they want to exploit us. Or they want to use us, they want to enjoy us as some sort of a fashion. But in the hearts, there is often the negative energy of envy. Historical example, King Louis XIV of France. Did you ever see his palace in Versailles? Even to this day, hundreds and hundreds of years later, it's one of the most beautiful palaces in the entire world. The opulences, the art, the architecture, it's absolutely magnificent. And what he would do is he would invite the noblemen, the princes, the kings of other countries to come to his palace, and he would simply entertain them. He would give them magnificent rooms, magnificent wine, magnificent food, magnificent gifts, and so much incredible entertainment. Just to show them what he had. So that they would honor him. But it had a complete opposite effect. They were enjoying all his facilities, but their hearts were burning with envy secretly. And they plotted and conspired and turned all of his own people against him, his own subjects. These are the subjects that he was leading. You know the story when they were hungry and it came to his wife, Marie Antoinette, and she said, "They're hungry, give them cake." She was out of touch with their needs. She was working them. She was taking all the benefits of having them. But as a leader, she did not see them as sentient humans that had deep needs, and that as the queen, it was her service to the citizens and service to God to actually inspire them, encourage them, and provide for them. And her husband was the same way. And ultimately, they cut off her head and they cut off his head and they took everything away. Adipo. Is that leadership? Today in the world, so many governments, do they really trust their leaders? So many businesses, do they trust their leaders? Even in religions, it's very rare that people really trust their leaders. If we don't win people's trust, if we don't win people's faith as leaders, then we're failing on whatever level. In India, I know some very, very successful, powerful businessmen. But how they treat their employees, it's incredible. Because they treat their employees with so much respect, with so much honor, so much care, even though there's thousands and thousands of them, they've developed a network like that, that these people are actually loyal to them. They're dedicated to them. They're not forming labor unions to get raises from them. They feel protected. They feel love. They feel valued. Spiritual leadership is to show real, genuine value, respect, and concern for the people we're leading as an expression of the love of our hearts. And the natural reciprocation is they trust you and love you, and they're dedicated to you. There's histories of great kings who treated every citizen like their own sons and daughters. And the result was all the citizens were God-conscious. They were spiritually enlightened, just like the king. Because they loved him like a father and the queen like a mother. This is historical. In today's American society, it may seem something very theoretical, something very idealistic. But if we're not part of the solution, we're part of the problem. So please understand the great importance of the responsibility of taking any type of position as a leader. And spiritual leadership is based on the principle of humility and not being the master, but being the servant. Even in the post of a master, to be a servant. Our own spiritual master, our own guru, Srila Prabhupada, he had tens and thousands of disciples all over the world who would do anything and everything for him. Why? Because of his humility and love. When he first started this movement in the Lower East Side of New York in 26 Second Avenue, he was cooking for the people. He was serving the people the food. He was cleaning up after them. He didn't want anything for himself. He only wanted to give. And he gave them the most sacred thing in his life, divine knowledge and divine inspiration as a service. And what was the result? People would do anything and everything for him. And this was really a cultural contradiction. Because in the 1960s in America, especially in New York City, the motto was, for the young generation, never trust anyone above 30. Did you ever hear this? That was our motto. It was like the battle cry of our generation. Never trust anyone above 30. We were all teenagers and in our early 20s. Now all these people are in their 50s and 60s. So never trust anyone above 30. Here comes Prabhupada. He's 70 years old. He's older than our grandparents. And because of his humility, because of his love, because of his selfless service, we wanted to understand what he was saying. And these people, not only would they listen to him, but they would do anything and everything. And he never said, I'm the master. He always said, I'm the servant. He would say, you are all the representatives of my guru. Whether he was living very humbly as he came to America with no money and no contacts and nothing. He's living in Bowery. And a few years later, he had 108 beautiful temples, palaces, castles all over the world with tens and thousands of followers and millions of books being distributed. George Harrison of the Beatles was making songs about him and he was living in John Lennon's estate. He came to a very high level of success, but he never changed. Nothing is mine. The only thing that belongs to me is my service to all of you. Yes, that is spiritual leadership. Spiritual leadership is that humility of the heart to understand that God is the proprietor and the enjoyer. We are all servants, and how we can serve each other is the greatest benediction. It is a fact. A person with real spiritual virtue knows that greater than attaining all the wealth of this world is the chance to show compassion and serve a person in need of God's grace, to be an instrument of a power beyond ourselves, and to recognize that is real humility. I'll repeat that. Real humility is to understand that whatever good we do, we're instruments of a power beyond ourselves. We're instruments of a divine person that is beyond ourselves. Whether it's in spiritual circles, in law, in politics, in business, in engineering, in any field of life, enlightenment and fulfillment comes when we apply this principle very carefully to our lives. What is important is the cleansing of our hearts. This is the basic principle of all spiritual paths. It is, in a sense, the essence of all religion. Spirituality or religion is never a sectarian thing. The human ego makes the sectarianism. But the essence of every holy teaching is the need to cleanse or purify our consciousness, to bring our consciousness to its original natural spiritual state. If a drop of water falls from the sky, originally it's transparent. But when that drop comes in contact with the dirt, it becomes muddy. And to the degree it gathers that dirt, it loses its transparent quality. But when you filter that water, what happens? The filtering simply means to separate what is not water from what is pure water. And we bring the water to its original, natural, transparent state. So our consciousness, our spirit self within, is pure. It is part and parcel of the Supreme. Our nature is to love. Our nature is to be happy. Not just happy, to be in ecstasy. People look for that ecstasy in so many ways, through intoxications, through music, through theater, through television, through various types of relationships, through buying so many things, being so many things. But the ecstasy is within us. It's the ecstasy of our natural love for God and for every living being in relation to God. When we simply clean our heart of the selfish, egoistic greed and pride and envy and anger and lust, then what is left? Our true self, our true love, and our true happiness. We see that in all spiritual traditions, the accomplished leaders of all such spiritual traditions, they may speak in different languages, they may wear different dress, they may have different hairstyles, they may perform different rituals, they may approach God or the Supreme with different names. But there's something that all such realized saintly persons have in common: their qualities. They're instruments of love. They're instruments of compassion. They're self-controlled. If we're controlled by our own insatiable desires, if we cannot control our senses, then we will be victimized to so many immoral, unethical things in due course of time. A person who has some spiritual substance is a person who has control over their mind and senses. A person who is intoxicated far beyond the intoxications that any of the drugs or alcohol in this world can provide. They're intoxicated with ecstatic love. They're finding great inner fulfillment. And they're willing to perform great sacrifices in the service of others by helping to enlighten them. Self-control, compassion, inner peace and happiness, integrity, morality. These are the common principles of anybody who has made progress on any spiritual path. We are not speaking about a sectarian concern. We're speaking about the universal principle of truth and coming in contact with that truth. In order to do that, we must put time aside every day to cultivate that cleansing of the heart, to cultivate our spiritual virtues. In our own tradition, Vaishnavism, we do this through chanting God's names, this Maha Mantra, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. These are sacred names of God. God has many names. And by chanting these names with a humble heart, we cleanse our hearts. We awaken our original, eternal nature. So it is so very important. For spiritual leadership, there must be regular cultivation of our spiritual nature, of our spiritual virtues, and the right priorities in life. What priorities we make in every aspect of life is what is going to bring us either forward or down, backward. So it is my humble request to all of you students who are actually the future leaders of the world in practically every field for the future to please take this very seriously. What one person can do if they are a good example to uplift, to enlighten, and to give fulfillment to the people in our environment is priceless. Keep your values very high. Character counts more than anything else. Realization. Realization is the most precious thing we can attain. Realization of truth and love. Please hold this sacred. And go into the world according to your inclinations. Spiritual leadership means to work within this world, but to do the least harm to others and the most possible good for others. And that is the great opportunity that is there for all of us. And especially in youth, when we are formulating the directions we're going to go for our whole life, it is a very important time to really contemplate, what is it that I am going to hold sacred in my life? What is it that I really want to achieve? And how do I want to really serve humanity, God, and the world? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Swamiji. If anyone has questions, His Holiness is willing to answer questions for a while. And also, if you have questions for the other monks, you can address that also. Okay.
Would you like to ask any question? Yes.
How do you know when you're ready to be with you and what you do in the meantime?
Prepare. How do we know when we're ready to be a leader? And what do we do in the meantime? Really, our aspiration should be to serve. Leadership is just a very, very wonderful opportunity to serve. Yes? We shouldn't be attached to being a leader. We should be attached to the service that we can render. Sometimes people strive to be a leader because they really feel that they can do a great service to society. Sometimes people don't have any inclination to be a leader, but because of their selfless service, others put them in a position of leadership. Yes, that often happens. Sometimes the most qualified person to be a leader is someone who doesn't want to be a leader. But actually, whether we're leading our household as a family, whether we're leading in a circle of small friends, whether we're leading a business or an entire nation, we should all cultivate and strive to be leaders by our example, by the words we speak and by the example that we live. I have seen humble street sweepers. Their character and their virtue is so good. I heard a story from a very great personality. There was just a lady street sweeper. But she had such good qualities that even very, very learned people were learning just by watching her. You could be a leader in any field of life. The real thing is to lead by setting an example of high ideals, high integrity. That is a leader. Yes? And whether we come to the top of the particular field that we're working in or not, we can be a great leader by living with character, integrity, and devotion. Does that answer your question? Yes. Can you speak a little louder, please? Explain more about God? Janmadya Shayataha. That the absolute truth is from whom everything emanates. The cause of all causes. The source of everything. The origin of all that exists. In Bhagavad Gita, there's a beautiful verse, Aham. What is that? Aham sarvasya prabhava mata sarvam pravartate. Iti matva bhajante mam buddha bhava samanvata. The absolute truth is the source of all spiritual and material worlds from whom everything emanates. The father, the mother of all living beings, of whom we are all part and parcel. Just like there is the sun planet, and there are infinite sun rays, yes? Each sun ray is of the same quality as the sun planet, but it is infinitesimal in quantity. You cannot say that the sun is coming from the sun ray, yes? But we understand clearly that the sun rays, all of them, infinite sun rays, they are all emanating from the sun. So we are all like those sun rays, and God is that sun from whom everything emanates. And in different traditions, it explains different angles of vision of that one supreme truth. Brahmeti Bhagavan, Brahmeti Paramatmeti Bhagavan Iti Sabjate. That there are three principal features of the absolute truth. The impersonal, all-pervading energy of the Lord, which some people are striving to understand as supreme, which is like understanding the unlimited sunshine. That is God, the energy of the Lord. There's also the Lord who is seated within the heart of every living being, the Paramatma, the Lord within the heart, who is the witness and who is reciprocating with our desires and our prayers. And according to the Srimad Bhagavat, Bhagavad Gita, there is also the Lord who is the supreme, all-attractive object of love, the supreme person. We all want to love someone who has the unlimited, eternal capacity to reciprocate with our love. Yes? The name Krishna means all-attractive. Krishna is not a sectarian name. The essence of all traditions' understanding of God is that God is all-attractive, supremely beautiful, supremely merciful and kind. Yes? Has all opulences. In the Gita, it explains whatever attracts us in this world is just an infinitesimal spark of the splendor of God. So God is the supreme object of love and attraction. And when we simply direct the soul's nature toward cultivating love of God, we find the infinite, ultimate experience of joy. And the greatest truth in life is in whatever we do, whether we're farmers or housewives or teachers or business people or doctors or monks, whatever we do through our occupation, through our skills, through our intelligence, we want to express and share that love. That is the essence and the basis all the great spiritual traditions on earth. Does that answer your question? Is there any other questions? Govinda, would you like to speak something? Please come. This is the first time he's ever come to India, just a few days ago. I mean, come from India. He's from a village in India, and he has so many thousands and thousands of people who love him dearly there. Please come. No? Is there any other questions? Yes, please.
There was a talk given sometime last semester where they had a Christian, a secular humanist, and a Buddhist come and speak about their views on faith and how they live their daily lives. And someone asked a question about the tsunami that took place in Indonesia and how each one reflected on that and how they helped people around them. And the Christian said that without falling or without seeing something that is terrible or that hurts lots of people, you don't know how to overcome that or how to become better. And I was reminded of a verse from the Gita where it talks about how the Supreme gives everyone all their qualities, whether it's goodness or, you know, happiness, anxiety, everything. And I was wondering whether we need examples like WorldCom and like 9/11 in order to see what not to be and in order to become a better leader. As in, so basically, how do you know what a good leader is, save for the humility and that aspect of it? As in, like, do you need sort of bad examples from which to learn from? I mean, is there a point to WorldCom and Enron and 9/11?
Did everyone hear the question? Should I try to repeat it? There was a seminar with a secular humanist, a Buddhist, and a Christian, and they were discussing various subjects. And one of the topics they were discussing was this tsunami that took place in Asia. And the Christian man was explaining how human society needs to see such massive disasters in order to change their lives and actually become better and turn to God. Something like that? And your question is, do we need things like that?
Right. How would you respond?
How would I respond? How would you respond? Her response is that I should respond. Thank you. It is an unfortunate situation when major disasters have to come in human society for people to really sincerely and honestly reevaluate their values and their direction in life. That is very sad, but often that's what it takes. And some people, even though those things are happening, they still will not question. But yes, after these disasters in New York City and these corporate disasters that took place, yes, many people are questioning what really is a value, what really is success, what is of permanence. What is sacred in life? Sometimes the material facade has to crumble before we look to see what's behind it or what's beyond it. That's very unfortunate. It is, you have heard the saying, experience is the best teacher. Do you know the second half of it? People conveniently like to quote the first half, but very few people know the second half of that saying. The saying is, experience is the best teacher, and a fool learns by no other way. An intelligent person will learn by hearing. He or she doesn't have to experience it. You hear that stealing is bad. Do you have to steal and get punished and put in jail before you actually before you learn that you shouldn't steal? That is a less intelligent platform. The best thing is to learn, to hear from proper sources, and to accept it. So we have that choice, whether we want to learn by hearing or whether we want to learn by seeing from these disasters. But these disasters are coming anyway. And the cause of these disasters, we cannot blame God for the massive karma that is being created by human society. It's predicted philosophically in all traditions, that individual karma an accumulated karma must have reactions. If there's massive violence, cruelty, and disrespect for the laws of earth and nature, there will be massive reactions. That's just how nature works. If our parents give us a beautiful house and we set it on fire, do we blame our parents? If your parents give you a house and you're grown people and you have a party with your Columbia University friends and you're drinking and you're smoking all kinds of different smokes and you're playing all kinds of music and you're just intoxicated and crazy, and then you start fighting each other and you start throwing things at each other, and then you start a fire and the whole house burns down, do you say, well, do you blame your father and mother? You're the one that give us the house. So similarly, God has given us his world and he's given us everything within the world to live nicely. But when there's slaughter of millions of animals and slaughter of humans and with disrespect and plundering the earth in so many ways and polluting things unnaturally, we're creating situations where there's inevitably going to be disasters. So when the disasters come, it's very sad. But we should be introspective, how to be a part of the solution rather than just being a part of the problem. It's easy to say, who am I to change anything? I may as well just coast along with the tsunami wave of the way society's going today. Yes? But real sincerity in life is, it doesn't matter what the world is doing. What matters is that I live according to the right principles, that I live in harmony with what I know is sacred and true. Yes? So there is much to learn by the disasters of the world, both philosophically, emotionally, sociologically. Many lessons to be learned. And there's much to be learned by the prosperities that are taking place. We should learn in life, and we should learn to see through the eyes of wisdom, not just see through the perspective that a commercialistic world is teaching us. I remember our Guru Maharaj, Prabhupada, he was driving down a highway in America, and there was a big billboard, and there was a very handsome man and beautiful woman under a very, very natural, refreshing waterfall. And they were both smoking cigarettes. And the advertisement said, be refreshingly cool, smoke cool. And he looked at this. He's coming from another culture. He's just looking at it objectively. He said, they're breathing in fire. And they're being told that it's cool. And they believe it. They're buying it. They're thinking it's cool. It's cool. It's breathing in fire. It's killing you. But it's cool. So yes, people want us to see a certain way. People want us to think a certain way. Not because they're selflessly trying to make us happy. Because they want to exploit us for our money or our energies. Yes? So we should actually see through the eyes of wisdom, through the eyes of the scriptures, through the eyes of enlightened people, through the eyes of our own purified consciousness. And then we could actually be enriched and learn through all the various experiences that we pass through and through all the various experiences that the world is passing through. Does that answer your question? So, Any person who has a soft heart is going to suffer when they see the sufferings of others. But at the same time, we should always be trying to enrich our own understandings and values of life through whatever phases we pass through in this world. Things are very temporary. You know, this wave killed so many. But how many people are being killed of cancer and lung cancer from smoking cigarettes? And colon cancer from eating too much the wrong foods? How many children are aborted in a day? How many animals are slaughtered in a day? There's a lot of violence in this world that doesn't get so much press. We should be sensitive. We should learn to respect all forms of life and be sympathetic, empathetic toward the sufferings of all others. Also, the soul is eternal. Death is not the end. Death is a beginning, if we have wisdom. It's the beginning of either a miserable situation, a wonderful situation, or a completely liberated situation, depending on our consciousness. Trees live sometimes 1,000 years. There are redwood trees in Northern California that are 5,000 to 7,000 years old. That's not a great life. The speciality of human life is its quality. What are we conscious of? The speciality, the special feature of human life is we could realize our eternal blissful nature. We could realize our relationship with the Supreme. Trees cannot do that. Animals cannot do that. Humans can do that. And yes, we do not know what tomorrow will bring. I know so many people who died in traffic accidents. So life is precious at the moment. To think that we have a long, long time to live. Because when that wave does come, when that wave of time separates us from this body, we cannot take anything with us except the virtue of the consciousness which we have developed in our life. So we should take it very seriously. That is a lesson from all of this. We feel very sympathetic and for those who have suffered and those who are suffering and those who are died. But at the same time, we want to learn that life is temporary. And we don't know, just because we're young, it doesn't mean we're going to live long. What is the quality of our life? Are we so much attached and enamored by those things that are inevitably going to be taken away? Or are we cultivating attachment for that which is eternal, that which is real and spiritual? That is something we should all be contemplating. Does that answer your question? Thank you. So I think we will end here. I'm very grateful you tolerated me for a very long time tonight. Thank you very, very much.